Book 6 Chapter 23 After 5 months of exile in Sicily, Michael Corleone came finally to understand his father's character and his destiny. He came to understand men like Luco Brasi, the ruthless caporegime Clemenza, his mother's resignation and acceptance of her role. For in Sicily he saw what they would have been if they had chosen not to struggle against their fate. He understood why the Don always said, "A man has only one destiny." He came to understand the contempt for authority and legal government, the hatred for any man who broke omerta, the law of silence. Dressed in old clothes and a billed cap, Michael had been transported from the ship docked at Palermo to the interior of the Sicilian island, to the very heart of a province controlled by the mafia, where the local capo mafioso was greatly indebted to his father for some past service. The province held the town of Corleone, whose name the Don had taken when he emigrated to America so long ago. But there were no longer any of the Don's relatives alive. The women had died of old age. All the men had been killed in vendettas, or had also emigrated, either to America, Brazil, or to some other province on the Italian mainland. He was to learn later that this small, poverty-stricken town had the highest murder rate of any place in the world. Michael was installed as a guest in the home of a bachelor uncle of the capo mafioso. The uncle, in his 70s, was also the doctor for the district. The capo mafioso was a man in his late 50s named Don Tomasino, and he operated as the gabolotto for a huge estate belonging to one of Sicily's most noble families. The gabolotto, a sort of overseer to the estates of the rich, also guaranteed that the poor would not try to claim land not being cultivated, would not try to encroach in any way on the estate by poaching or trying to farm it as squatters. In short, the gabolotto was a mafioso who, for a certain sum of money, protected the real estate of the rich from all claims made on it by the poor, legal or illegal. When any poor peasant tried to implement the law which permitted him to buy uncultivated land, the gabolotto frightened him off with threats of bodily harm or death. It was that simple. Don Tomasino also controlled the water rights in the area and vetoed the local building of any new dams by the Roman government. Such dams would ruin the lucrative business of selling water from the artesian wells he controlled, make water too cheap, ruin the whole important water economy so laboriously built up over hundreds of years. However, Don Tomasino was an old-fashioned mafia chief and would have nothing to do with dope traffic or prostitution. In this, Don Tomasino was at odds with the new breed of mafia leaders springing up in big cities like Palermo. New men who, influenced by American gangsters deported to Italy, had no such scruples. The mafia chief was an extremely portly man, a man with a belly, literally as well as in the figurative sense that meant a man able to inspire fear in his fellow men. Under his protection, Michael had nothing to fear, yet it was considered necessary to keep the fugitive's identity a secret. And so, Michael was restricted to the walled estate of Dr. Tazza, the Don's uncle. Dr. Tazza was tall for a Sicilian, almost 6 feet, and had ruddy cheeks and snow-white hair. Though in his 70s, he went every week to Palermo to pay his respects to the younger prostitutes of that city, the younger the better. Dr. Tazza's other vice was reading. He read everything, and talked about what he read to his fellow townsmen, patients who were illiterate peasants, the estate shepherds, and this gave him a local reputation for foolishness. What did books have to do with them? In the evenings, Dr. Tazza, Don Tomasino, and Michael sat in the huge garden populated with those marble statues that on this island seemed to grow out of the garden as magically as the black heady grapes. Dr. Tazza loved to tell stories about the mafia and its exploits over the centuries, and in Michael Corleone, he had a fascinated listener. There were times when even Don Tomasino would be carried away by the balmy air, the fruity, intoxicating wine, the elegant and quiet comfort of the garden, and tell a story from his own practical experience. The doctor was the legend, the Don the reality. In this antique garden, Michael Corleone learned about the roots from which his father grew. That the word mafia had originally meant place of refuge. Then it became the name for the secret organization that sprang up to fight against the rulers who had crushed the country and its people for centuries. Sicily was a land that had been more cruelly raped than any other in history. The Inquisition had tortured rich and poor alike. The land-owning barons and the princes of the Catholic Church exercised absolute power over the shepherds and farmers. The police were the instruments of their power, and so identified with them that to be called a policeman is the foulest insult one Sicilian can hurl at another. Faced with the savagery of this absolute power, the suffering people learned never to betray their anger and their hatred for fear of being crushed. They learned never to make themselves vulnerable by uttering any sort of threat, since giving such a warning ensured a quick reprisal. They learned that society was their enemy, and so when they sought redress for their wrongs, they went to the rebel underground, the mafia. And the mafia cemented its power by originating the law of silence, the omerta. In the countryside of Sicily, a stranger asking directions to the nearest town will not even receive the courtesy of an answer. And the greatest crime any member of the mafia could commit would be to tell the police the name of the man who had just shot him or done him any kind of injury. Omerta became the religion of the people. A woman whose husband had been murdered would not tell the police the name of her husband's murderer, not even of her child's murderer, her daughter's raper. Justice had never been forthcoming from the authorities, and so the people had always gone to the Robin Hood Mafia. And, to some extent, the Mafia still fulfilled this role. People turned to their local capo mafioso for help in every emergency. He was their social worker, their district captain, ready with a basket of food and a job, their protector. But what Dr. Tazza did not add, what Michael learned on his own in the months that followed, was that the mafia in Sicily had become the illegal arm of the rich and even the auxiliary police of the legal and political structure. It had become a degenerate capitalist structure, anti-communist, anti-liberal, placing its own taxes on every form of business endeavor, no matter how small. Michael Corleone understood for the first time why men like his father chose to become thieves and murderers rather than members of the legal society. The poverty and fear and degradation were too awful to be acceptable to any man of spirit. And in America, some emigrating Sicilians had assumed that there would be an equally cruel authority. Dr. Tazza offered to take Michael into Palermo with him on his weekly visit to the bordello, but Michael refused. His flight to Sicily had prevented him from getting proper medical treatment for his smashed jaw, and he now carried a memento from Captain McCluskey on the left side of his face. The bones had knitted badly, throwing his profile askew, giving him the appearance of depravity when viewed from that side. He had always been vain about his looks, and this upset him more than he thought possible. The pain that came and went he didn't mind at all. Dr. Tazza gave him some pills that deadened it. Tazza offered to treat his face, but Michael refused. He had been there long enough to learn that Dr. Tazza was perhaps the worst physician in Sicily. Dr. Tazza read everything but his medical literature, which he admitted he could not understand. He had passed his medical exams through the good offices of the most important mafia chief in Sicily, who had made a special trip to Palermo to confer with Tazza's professors about what grades they should give him. And this, too, showed how the mafia in Sicily was cancerous to the society it inhabited. Merit meant nothing. Talent meant nothing. Work meant nothing. The mafia godfather gave you your profession as a gift. Michael had plenty of time to think things out. During the day, he took walks in the countryside, always accompanied by two of the shepherds attached to Don Tomasino's estate. The shepherds of the island were often recruited to act as the mafia's hired killers and did their job simply to earn money to live. Michael thought about his father's organization. If it continued to prosper, it would grow into what had happened here on this island, so cancerous that it would destroy the whole country. Sicily was already a land of ghosts, its men emigrating to every other country on earth to be able to earn their bread, or simply to escape being murdered for exercising their political and economic freedoms. On his long walks, the most striking thing in Michael's eyes was the magnificent beauty of the country. He walked through the orange orchards that formed shady, deep caverns through the countryside, with their ancient conduits splashing water out of the fanged mouths of great snake stones carved before Christ. Houses built like ancient Roman villas, with huge marble portals and great vaulted rooms, falling into ruins or inhabited by stray sheep. On the horizon, the bony hills shone like picked bleached bones piled high. Gardens and fields, sparkly green, decorated the desert landscape like bright emerald necklaces. And sometimes he walked as far as the town of Corleone, its 18,000 people strung out in dwellings that pitted the side of the nearest mountain, the mean hovels built out of black rock quarried from that mountain. In the last year there had been over 60 murders in Corleone, and it seemed that death shadowed the town. Further on, the wood of Ficusa broke the savage monotony of arable plain. His two shepherd bodyguards always carried their lupadas with them when accompanying Michael on his walks. The deadly Sicilian shotgun was the favorite weapon of the mafia. Indeed, the police chief sent by Mussolini to clean the mafia out of Sicily had, as one of his first steps, ordered all stone walls in Sicily to be knocked down to not more than 3 feet in height, so that murderers with their lupadas could not use the walls as ambush points for their assassinations. This didn't help much, and the police minister solved his problem by arresting and deporting to penal colonies any male suspected of being a mafioso. When the island of Sicily was liberated by the Allied armies, the American military government officials believed that anyone imprisoned by the fascist regime was a Democrat, and many of these mafiosi were appointed as mayors of villages or interpreters to the military government. This good fortune enabled the mafia to reconstitute itself and become more formidable than ever before. The long walks, a bottle of strong wine at night with a heavy plate of pasta and meat, enabled Michael to sleep. There were books in Italian in Dr. Tazza's library, and though Michael spoke dialect Italian and had taken some college courses in Italian, his reading of these books took a great deal of effort and time. His speech became almost accentless, and though he could never pass as a native of the district, it would be believed that he was one of those strange Italians from the far north of Italy bordering the Swiss and Germans. The distortion of the left side of his face made him more native. It was the kind of disfigurement common in Sicily because of the lack of medical care. The little injury that cannot be patched up simply for lack of money. Many children, many men bore disfigurements that in America would have been repaired by minor surgery or sophisticated medical treatments. Michael often thought of Kay, of her smile, her body, and always felt a twinge of conscience at leaving her so brutally without a word of farewell. Oddly enough, his conscience was never troubled by the two men he had murdered. Salozzo had tried to kill his father. Captain McCluskey had disfigured him for life. Dr. Tazza always kept after him about getting surgery done for his lopsided face, especially when Michael asked him for pain-killing drugs, the pain getting worse as time went on and more frequent. Tazza explained that there was a facial nerve below the eye from which radiated a whole complex of nerves. Indeed, this was the favorite spot for mafia torturers, who searched it out on the cheeks of their victims with the needle-fine point of an ice pick. That particular nerve in Michael's face had been injured, or perhaps there was a splinter of bone lanced into it. Simple surgery in a Palermo hospital would permanently relieve the pain. Michael refused. When the doctor asked why, Michael grinned and said, "It's something from home." And he really didn't mind the pain, which was more an ache, a small throbbing in his skull, like a motored apparatus running in liquid to purify it. It was nearly 7 months of leisurely rustic living before Michael felt real boredom. At about this time, Don Tomasino became very busy, and was seldom seen at the villa. He was having his troubles with the new mafia springing up in Palermo, young men who were making a fortune out of the post-war construction boom in that city. With this wealth, they were trying to encroach on the country fiefs of old-time mafia leaders, whom they contemptuously labeled Mustache Pete's. Don Tomasino was kept busy defending his domain. And so Michael was deprived of the old man's company and had to be content with Dr. Tazza's stories, which were beginning to repeat themselves. One morning, Michael decided to take a long hike to the mountains beyond Corleone. He was, naturally, accompanied by the two shepherd bodyguards. This was not really a protection against enemies of the Corleone family. It was simply too dangerous for anyone not a native to go wandering about by himself. It was dangerous enough for a native. The region was loaded with bandits, with mafia partisans fighting against each other and endangering everybody else in the process. He might also be mistaken for a palleo thief. A palleo is a straw-thatched hut erected in the fields to house farming tools and to provide shelter for the agricultural laborers so that they will not have to carry them on the long walk from their homes in the village. In Sicily, the peasant does not live on the land he cultivates. It is too dangerous, and any arable land, if he owns it, is too precious. Rather, he lives in his village, and at sunrise begins his voyage out to work in distant fields, a commuter on foot. A worker who arrived at his palleo and found it looted was an injured man indeed. The bread was taken out of his mouth for that day. The mafia, after the law proved helpless, took this interest of the peasant under its protection and solved the problem in typical fashion. It hunted down and slaughtered all palleo thieves. It was inevitable that some innocents suffered. It was possible that if Michael wandered past the palleo that had just been looted, he might be adjudged the criminal unless he had somebody to vouch for him. So on one sunny morning he started hiking across the fields, followed by his two faithful shepherds. One of them was a plain, simple fellow, almost moronic, silent as the dead and with a face as impassive as an Indian's. He had the wiry small build of the typical Sicilian before they ran to the fat of middle age. His name was Carlo. The other shepherd was more outgoing, younger, and had seen something of the world. Mostly oceans, since he had been a sailor in the Italian Navy during the war, and had just had time enough to get himself tattooed before his ship was sunk and he was captured by the British. But the tattoo made him a famous man in his village. Sicilians do not often let themselves be tattooed. They do not have the opportunity nor the inclination. The shepherd Fabrizio had done so primarily to cover a splotchy red birthmark on his belly. And yet the mafia market carts had gaily painted scenes on their sides, beautifully primitive paintings done with loving care. In any case, Fabrizio, back in his native village, was not too proud of that tattoo on his chest, though it showed a subject dear to the Sicilian honor. A husband stabbing a naked man and woman entwined together on the hairy floor of his belly. Fabrizio would joke with Michael and ask questions about America, for of course it was impossible to keep them in the dark about his true nationality. Still, they did not know exactly who he was, except that he was in hiding and there could be no babbling about him. Fabrizio sometimes brought Michael a fresh cheese, still sweating the milk that formed it. They walked along dusty country roads, passing donkeys pulling gaily painted carts. The land was filled with pink flowers, orange orchards, groves of almond and olive trees all blooming. That had been one of the surprises. Michael had expected a barren land because of the legendary poverty of Sicilians, and yet he had found it a land of gushing plenty, carpeted with flowers scented by lemon blossoms. It was so beautiful that he wondered how its people could bear to leave it. How terrible man had been to his fellow man could be measured by the great exodus from what seemed to be a Garden of Eden. He had planned to walk to the coastal village of Mazara, and then take a bus back to Corleone in the evening, and so tire himself out and be able to sleep. The two shepherds wore rucksacks filled with bread and cheese they could eat on the way. They carried their luparas quite openly, as if out for a day's hunting. It was a most beautiful morning. Michael felt as he had felt when, as a child, he had gone out early on a summer day to play ball. Then each day had been freshly washed, freshly painted, and so it was now. Sicily was carpeted in gaudy flowers, the scent of orange and lemon blossoms so heavy that even with his facial injury, which pressed on the sinuses, he could smell it. The smashing on the left side of his face had completely healed, but the bone had formed improperly, and the pressure on his sinuses made his left eye hurt. It also made his nose run continually. He filled up handkerchiefs with mucus and often blew his nose out onto the ground as the local peasants did, a habit that had disgusted him when he was a boy and had seen old Italians disdaining handkerchiefs as English foppery blow out their noses in the asphalt gutters. His face, too, felt heavy. Dr. Tazze had told him that this was due to the pressure on his sinuses caused by the badly healed fracture. Dr. Tazze called it an eggshell fracture of the zygoma, that if it had been treated before the bones knitted, it could have been easily remedied by a minor surgical procedure using an instrument like a spoon to push out the bone to its proper shape. Now, however, said the doctor, he would have to check into a Palermo hospital and undergo a major procedure called maxillofacial surgery, where the bone would be broken again. That was enough for Michael. He refused. And yet more than the pain, more than the nose dripping, he was bothered by the feeling of heaviness in his face. He never reached the coast that day. After going about 15 miles, he and his shepherds stopped in the cool, green, watery shade of an orange grove to eat lunch and drink their wine. Fabrizio was chattering about how he would some day get to America. After drinking and eating, they lolled in the shade, and Fabrizio unbuttoned his shirt and contracted his stomach muscles to make the tattoo come alive. The naked couple on his chest writhed in a lover's agony, and the dagger thrust by the husband quivered in their transfixed flesh. It amused them. It was while this was going on that Michael was hit with what the Sicilians call the thunderbolt. Beyond the orange grove lay the green-ribboned fields of a baronial estate. Down the road from the grove was a villa so Roman it looked as if it had been dug up from the ruins of Pompeii. It was a little palace with a huge marble portico and fluted Grecian columns, and through those columns came a bevy of village girls flanked by two stout matrons clad in black. They were from the village and had obviously fulfilled their ancient duty to the local baron by cleaning his villa and otherwise preparing it for his winter sojourn. Now they were going into the fields to pick the flowers with which they would fill the rooms. They were gathering the pink sula, purple wisteria, mixing them with orange and lemon blossoms. The girls, not seeing the men resting in the orange grove, came closer and closer.